We've been studying church history. And we're going to keep studying it. Just to get across the point that the church has always had to deal with the problem of having people in it. And the problems of the church usually occur when some of those people forget their people and think they're God or his only right representative on earth. I thought you might like to get acquainted, just to take a little break from the heavy history of the early church, to get acquainted with those translators of the King James Version of the Bible. Translators Revived, Biographical Notes of the King James Version Bible Translators by Alexander McClure. Lancelot Andrews. You don't have to remember all their names. You'll start to get a feel that most of them have a little more training than Jimmy the Jerk. Lancelot Andrews was born at London in 1565. He trained chiefly at Merchant Taylor's School in his native city till he was appointed to one of the first Greek scholarships of Pembroke Hall in the University of Cambridge. Once a year at Easter, he used to pass a month with his parents. During this vacation, he would find a master from whom he learned some language to which he was before a stranger. In a month. In this way, after a few years, he acquired most of the modern languages of Europe. Well, he learned one every vacation. At the university, he gave himself chiefly to the Oriental tongues and to divinity. When he became candidate for a fellowship, there was but one vacancy, and he had a powerful competitor in Dr. Dove, who was afterwards Bishop of Peterborough. After long and severe examination, the matter was decided in favor of Andrews. But Dove, though vanquished, proved himself in this trial so fine a scholar that the college, unwilling to lose him, appointed him as a sort of supernumerary fellow. Andrews also received a complimentary appointment as fellow of Jesus College in the University of Oxford. In his own college, he was made a catechist. That is to say, a lecturer in divinity. Would you like to get acquainted with all the people that translated this thing? They included the Apocrypha. The Puritans took it out. American Bible Society and British Bible Society took it out. His conspicuous talents soon gained him powerful patrons. Henry, Earl of Huntingdon, took him into the north of England, where he was the means of converting many papists by his preaching and disputations. He converted a lot of Catholics. He was also warmly befriended by Sir Francis Walsingham, Secretary of State to Queen Elizabeth. Now, I would like to point out that if preachers were supposed to be what the news media would suggest, we wouldn't have a King James. Now, it, properly understood, is maybe the most valuable contribution to biblical literature ever produced. In spite of its weaknesses and problems, it's the one I preach from. Those who translated it were not as stupid as some who use it. Not as poverty-stricken, retarded, and second-rate as the news media would like to make all preachers. He was warmly befriended by Sir Francis Walsingham, Secretary of State to Queen Elizabeth. He was made parson of Alton in Hampshire and then vicar of St. Giles in London. He was afterward made prebendary and canon residentiary of St. Paul's and also of the Collegiate Church of Southwark. And probably St. Paul's, as a piece of real estate, is worth a great deal more than Heritage Village. I doubt 500 million would touch it. He was afterwards... Oh, I read that. He lectured on divinity at St. Paul's three times each week. On the death of Dr. Fulke in 1589, Dr. Andrews, though so young, was chosen master of Pembroke Hall, where he had received his education. While at the head of this college, he was one of its principal benefactors. It was rather poor at that time, but by his efforts, its endowments were much increased. He raised money. And at his death, many years later, he bequeathed to it, besides some plate, 300 folio volumes and £1,000 to found two fellowships. How about that? He was rich enough himself to found two fellowships. £1,000, a lot of money in those days. And 300 folio volumes that you don't buy for the same price you pay for a National Enquirer. I'm just sitting here by myself, taking on the whole world and its attitude about the church and the ministry. He gave up his mastership to become chaplain in ordinary to Queen Elizabeth. Now, of course, she was the head of the church. I'll bet you her castle cost more than Jim Baker's house at Fort Hill. Plus, she had summer palaces, vacation palaces, yachts. She's the head of the church of England. Now, there is nothing wrong with that tendency in mankind to want to add perks to the position of leadership as a testimonial of its value, regardless of who occupies it. There's an old saying in the Catholic Church that I can't say on the air, but I'll clean it up. The Pope may be illegitimate, but he's the Pope. You've got to distinguish between the position and the occupier of the position. Now, what is happening now is an age-old practice. Destroy the position because some occupier goofed up. I won't yield the point that it's morally wrong for a preacher of the gospel to have perks that go with leadership. You see some third world countries with starving people in their nation, with fancy embassies in Washington, D.C., very expensive embassies. I remember being in the Philippines in 1963, visiting La Honda, maybe one of the worst slums in the world. Right in the middle of the slums was the Catholic cathedral. Big stone walled and protected fence around it. And a couple of Mercedes sitting in the church courtyard for the priest to use. Now, at first glance, you have to say, Jesus said, sell what you have and give to the poor. But the Catholics of that slum area wouldn't have wanted that, didn't want that. Their community pride was involved in that church because Manalo, the Christ of the Philippines, a cultic religion, amalgam of many faiths, built vast and giant temples. They didn't want the testimonial of their faith to be viewed as second rate alongside Manalo, or Manalo rather. And I used to belittle some of the cheap missionary tricksters in this country that used to raise money, put roofs on churches in the Philippines. It was a nice little fundraising idea. Because it didn't cost as much to put a roof on a church as it did to build a whole church. And lots of businessmen could feel good about themselves saying, I roofed a church here and I roofed a church there and I roofed another church everywhere. Still teaching on church history, various phases of it, the general gestalt to you that joined us is a one-man crusade to take on the cosmos or viewpoint of this world. If you were of the world would love his own. And in this crazy society, most of the news media are atheistic or at the most agnostic and not very religious at best. They're the product of a materialistic society ruled by King Dollar, who resents the church having any of it. And I'm pointing out that the position of leadership in the church has to be distinguished from those who occupy it. And I was in the midst of describing a scene in the Philippines where I visited La Honda, the slums of the Philippines. And in the midst of those slums, the Catholic cathedral stood out in grandeur with Mercedes to drive the priests and the nuns around, parked behind their gates. And I said, I found no one in the Catholic community of that slum area that really believed in eternal things or the Catholic position that wanted that torn down to feed the poor. It was a testimonial of worship. Contracted a testimonial of worth, of worship. That's what worship means, worship. They didn't want their testimonial to the value of their God to play second fiddle to Manalo, the Christ of the Philippines. They were poor in the days when the pyramids were built. And there are still poor in Egypt. But no one goes to Egypt to visit the poor. I go to Egypt to visit the pyramids. One of the seven wonders of the world and the last to stand. And there were missionaries, Assembly of God missionaries, starting organizations to put roofs on churches in the Philippines. And businessmen delighted in the fact, oh, I'll roof the church here and roof the church there. And roof a church here, roof a church there, where roof, roof. At Baguio, the summer capital of the Philippines, I drove by one of the churches. The sign was all bent and dented. People had thrown rocks against it. The church was ill-kept and unpainted. And the missionary that was with me, a little two dozen people maybe that went to that church, their first request was, tell Brother So-and-so we need him to put a new roof on his church. You can stand in front of that dilapidated structure that had no sense of value to it, that had created bad Christians who wanted Brother So-and-so to put another roof on it, who had maintained it or taken care of it, and you could stand in front of it and see the giant temple to the faith in Manalo that was built in the same summer capital. What I dislike about the current flap-flap is the implication by a world that has no respect for God or the things of God that it's somehow wrong to heap perks on the testimonial and representative of leadership of religious faith. The general idea of the world is that if you are a religious leader, you should be poverty-stricken, retarded, or just plain generally stupid. And again, I repeat, I've been in Washington and seen some rather fancy embassies from third world countries that have starving people in them. They're not going to do business and improve the conditions of their country if they ask the powers that be in this country to come to a gathering at their embassy that is a storefront in the slums that's rented because they're putting all their money into the poor in their country. There are perks attached to leadership because of what leadership symbolizes. Now, there's just a lot of people, members of a church group that was considered across the tracks for so many years by the establishment church world, that were proud to take their friends and relatives to Charlotte, North Carolina, and say, look what we did for God. Now, that ain't my bag. I'd rather seize a territory in the heart of a great city and thumb my nose at the gods of mammon and say, we reserve the best for God. And nobody can ever fault me with, or those who help me. They can never fault us for having our sights too low. When we go for something, we go for it. I just wish there'd been more of us to go for it. And the last chapter ain't writ yet, friend. Which is why I'm trying to get you back on the track. I talked to some Jewish people. They invited me over to dinner. They said, if the Jewish rabbi doesn't drive a Cadillac at our synagogue, the people are going to get disturbed. It doesn't matter about whether or not he is deserving of a Cadillac and whether some hungry mouths among the poor have not been fed. their pride in their synagogue and the position of their rabbi, they want him driving a Cadillac. I never, ever gave to Heritage Village. I don't think that that's the way I want to be identified with representing to a world what I think about God. But I do understand the motive. It was to go first class for God. And they have a right to do that. That's the point. Now, they're being brainwashed by the media, because the media has a monopoly voice on the subject. And it's bang, 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 thump, 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 beat, beat, beat. Somehow it's wrong. To whom? You trying to tell me the people that gave the PTL didn't know what was being built there? My recollection is the few times I went by PTL, they were always showing it on the TV, taking tours of the rooms as if it's news to discover there's gold fixtures on the faucets of the suite, the presidential suite. They were creating their version of an embassy of God's kingdom on earth. And they were representing God's kingdom on earth. And I refuse to let the world say that God's kingdom on earth is only going to show its face in selling what you have and giving to the poor. Come on, let's have the scripture of the woman with the alabaster box pouring the precious ointment on Jesus and the disciples saying, why there's waste. I'm getting pretty good at obeying the Lord. I'm telling this story more frequently now. And the disciples said, why there's waste? This valuable ointment could have been sold for much money and the money given to the poor. Jesus said, leave her alone. She's done a good work unto me. You have the poor with you always. And wherever this gospel is preached, see to it that you tell what this woman has done. The one thing I admire the most about the Catholics is Vatican City. Now, I understand that they published their assets not long ago, $500 million. Based on what Van Gogh's sunflower sold for, I guess that the Cleopatra's Needle in the middle of St. Peter's Square would sell for that. Certainly was one to throw in the statues of the apostles around the rim of the Vatican. If Van Gogh went for $40 million, what do you think Michelangelo's ceiling in the Sistine Chapel would go for? Get off my back. I mean, if they're going to give us this crap about sell what you have and give to the poor, look, friends, let's feed all the poor and just concentrate on the Catholic Church. Starting with, he shouldn't come to Los Angeles and have that $3 million wasted. Try to tell a Catholic that. And I'm merely making a point. I'll be standing side by side with them, swinging with them at anybody trying to deny them the right to do this. They want to spend their money to have one glimpse in their lifetime and hold their kid up once to see the Pope. That's their right. Even though he's riding in a bulletproof wagon and bedecked with jewels that in terms of historic and antique value might rival. Just maybe the ring on his finger would sell for as much as Van Gogh's painting. Now, we're getting acquainted with, to take a little diversion from the heavy stuff we've been doing, the individuals who translated the King James Version of the Bible. To listen to Jimmy Swaggart, you'd think it was his possession. And the general subject matter I'm getting across is just because one guy messed up in the position of religious leadership gives no right for the tigers in the press to destroy the respect for the position of ministry that God intends for those that he has given to the church. A man's gift maketh room for him. And I'm not going to sit silent. I did a PhD at Stanford. I don't have to look for work. I've sold enough art to let me work free as a newscaster for 10 years. Not all ministers are jerks. Lancelot Andrews. This book is about those who were the committee of translators for the King James Version. He was born in London. Became was so smart that he would, on his vacation, once a year at Easter, he'd pass a month with his parents, and on this vacation he'd find a master from whom he learned some language to which he was before a stranger. In this way, after a few years, he acquired most of the modern languages of Europe, learning a language every year in a month. He became chaplain in ordinary to Queen Elizabeth. And he didn't die broke. When he died, he bequeathed, having raised the money for endowments of Pembroke Hall, the college he got his education at, he bequeathed some plate, 300 folio volumes, not cheap, and £1,000 to found two fellowships. Get the idea that a minister of the gospel is not supposed to have anything. You let the world cheapen what a minister does, and the devil's won. I happen to believe that the work that I do is worth more than what all the news media do. I just haven't believed that. I haven't believed I could do their job probably better than they do it. I mean, I sit in front of the camera. I don't need a cue card. I got a voice.
This is the end of side one. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.